So Emerson wrote, "There is some awe mixed with the joy of our surprise when this poet, who lived in some past world 200 or 300 years ago, says that which lies close to my own soul and that which I also had well nigh thought and said." Poetry and particular poems mean different things to different people. And it is often difficult to describe why we like one poem over another. But those poems speak to us, induce an emotional response, touch our spirit, and perhaps give us an understanding about something that we didn't even know that we were missing. Here are some reasons why we need poetry, as excerpted from a contribution by Dan Celotti in HuffPost. Read poetry so you never have to talk about meaning ever again, because poetry is unparaphrasable. Read poetry because the political and environmental realities make you weep, and poetry can help. Poetry can help. Read poetry because it offers no answers, no advice, no cures, just understanding and love. Life is so short, my friends, but poetry makes it last a bit longer. It does. It is true. Listen. Okay. The last Sunday of every month, we invite a family to light our chalice and give them a turn with our chalice lighting kit. Today, we are delighted to invite the Spaltaholz family, Bernard, Arne, and Matthias, to come forward to kindle the flame of our faith. The chalice lighting kit contains stories and activities which will give them lots of ideas for doing spiritual exploration together at home. And next up, it gets passed along to another family. On always helps.
Can you hear me now? Okay. I am Sarah Kendall, and my speech is not very strong today to tell you what I'm going to tell you. So I am going to read slowly, and I will say, slow your listening down, because that's the way you will hear me. Okay. I have always responded to a sense of awe in the world around me. At the age of 3, I would climb onto a bus going to the old town of Banbury in England and stand in front of a complete stranger. I would offer them beads from my tiny hand, or a daisy chain, or a heart, or a special shell found on a peach under the bleaching sun, just because I wanted the love to spread everywhere. Great thoughts and small thoughts evoked this in me. I just mentioned love from my childhood in England, love with a capital L, and awe for compassion, awe for nature, for art and for music, awe for the sunsets and the sunrise, awe for the intense connectedness of all who breathe on this planet. And it is this sense of awe that I capture in my poems, that which is bigger by far than the simple subject of the poem and leaves me struck by the sense of awe which is always around me. These 3 poems are descriptive, heartful poems about small occurrences which happened to me and which awoke in me a huge sense of the spirit which is larger than any of us, and that we can all feel it. Are you good? I'm good. I can hold it. Grandmother, for 6 days I have been watching tulips, strong, smooth petals, firm flask of color, vibrant, ripe, opening wide to catch the fierce light, stretching for all far beyond wide to font its dark gold center. I have watched as smoothness shrivels to ancient state, thick cream white faints to the old bone, fat stalk empties its green bough under the weight of just one petal. I have come to love the tulip as it withers, feel tender as I pass by, touch the dry leaf, stroke the paper-thin cheek, watch with soft eyes, and thrust fiercely to stop the hand that grabs. I settle it back into its vase, sing to it, move away, turn back to catch its memory, laugh like a leaf caught in ask, like a leaf caught in ice, and see the dust petal fall. The second moan is Bird Woman. Yes. Half awake, morning air slips in the window, cool against my cheek, light dabbles the wooden wall, blue sheets lap against the brass bed. I hear the bird. I feel him fill his small throat, his chest feathers white, soft, ruffled by the same cool air. The sweet notes of his song beat against my heart. Walls around me disappear, night can patches on a branch. As my body rises up into the tree, my beak opens, my lost songs flood out, strange and magnificent. I sing, I sing. And the last poem is called Heron. It is the same, it is the moment, breathing in and breathing out, stroke of heron's wing, gray breath against blue, infrequent drift of cherry blossom, white fallen on oval table below. The violin connecting still to Bach's fingers, passionate exploding from the string, shattering linear time. A soft curl of smoke, frankincense in the air like a whisper, the cracking open of pomegranate, clear, sweet redness of thinning juice. Image and memory collide, catch in my heart, surprise of wetness on my cheeks. It is the same. It is the moment.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Neda Hyde, and I am thrilled to be here. I feel quite awestruck by this occasion. I have lived a life of interweaving personal healing with helping women transform their lives and heal, first as a nurse and then as a psychologist, which I found a dynamite combination. I only in the past year, really, have I used the word poet to describe myself, or even used the word writer, even though I've been writing for decades. Learning sometimes can be slow. It can actually take a whole lifetime. And I've been on this planet 3/4 of a century, so it's taken a while. I'm going to read two poems this morning. One, they're both very short. The first one is called Wild Woman Gardens. And the first half of it is about my life in my family, which was a life of that looked like a perfect middle-class Toronto suburban family, but was actually full of secrets and silence and an injunction that the only feeling allowed was pleasant. So some of you may know that rule. So everything looked great for about 35 years, and I called my family perfect. So my friend, my therapist friend in New York tells me, and I say, really? Because I began private practice when I was about 35 and was found myself working in the very early days when nobody talked about incest and sexual abuse. And I had an absolute parade of women come into my office, all of whom, it seemed, not all, but, you know, a huge percentage, really. I questioned, you know, all of their various physical, emotional, and other, you know, aches, pains, and malaise. And they started having incest memories. And I started writing about that and teaching at the Justice Institute and teaching other therapists how to do that work to help women free themselves from the trauma of their backgrounds. Well, it may not surprise you, it took a while, but in my middle 40s, I went into therapy and I discovered that my grandfather had sexually abused me when I was a tiny infant. And it's absolutely wrong in our culture that we can't remember things back that far. We absolutely can. And I certainly did. And it made my whole life make sense because he also sexually abused my mother, who lived a life of absolute depression covered over by kind of pleasant smiles and social, you know, she was very good socially, so everything got covered over. Anyway, so that's been my life. And but the ending of the poem is transforming that life and helping women learn to transform fear and shame into love and connection for themselves first and then for others. And that's been an ever-evolving thing for me. And I will say that 15 years of my life, some of you may know, were really the acme of it when my partner, Helga Jacobson, who has just died this year, we developed and ran a women's healing center called Raven Spirit up in the Kootenays, focusing on shamanic healing. And we had women come and stay for five-day periods. And so we did lots of singing, dancing, art, writing, time out in nature, hiking, and I had a huge vegetable garden, and we had flower gardens, and it was all fantastic. So all of that was transformative, because beauty is so important to all of us, isn't it? So my first poem is Wild Woman Gardens. I have spent my life outgrowing every pot I was planted in. I am a gardener. I know root-bound what it feels like, pushing against clay, nutrient-hungry, parched. At least grapes crushed become wine. I was crushed by walls of silence. Silence is sneaky. It can be companionable, innocent, or deadly. I have to be with someone who embraces gardens, space, trees, whose wild love catapults her past reticence, over chasms, and into the dance. So I said that we focused on shamanic healing, which is really that everything that is alive has sentience or intelligence, and that we can use any of those things as teachers for us, ourselves. But we do have to ask. And I can tell you from working with really large numbers of women that it's very hard for us always to ask for what we need. So you can ask a rock, you can ask a tree, you can ask a plant. Any of those can be spirit guides for us and on out further on. So my second poem, called A Conspiracy of Ravens, reflects, it's kind of a fun poem, and it came to me last winter. I went and spent 3 weeks up in Masset on Haida Gwaii for some silence and solitude, and I was walking, strolling really slowly through the small town of Masset one morning, and right ahead of me was a woman with her little boy, and she was holding his hand, and they looked like they were having a nice time together. And it had rained the night before, and there were puddles on the road, and there were two ravens. There were huge, gorgeous ravens there all the time and everywhere, much larger than we have here. And the ravens were walking through the puddle, chattering to each other. So the little boy looked over at the ravens and said to his mother, "What are they doing?" And she said, "Oh, they're just talking together and playing in the puddle." I loved her easygoing response to her little boy. Birds talking to each other was the most normal thing in the world, as have all those spirits in nature become absolutely second nature to me. And certainly my raven spirit guide says I have to read this poem about ravens this morning. So one of the things in the poem is a reference to a word that I was supposed to use in a sentence that day. And part of what has impelled me forward in writing is that about 4 years ago, I joined a small group that we chose to write together every single day to a one-word prompt. And we organized ourselves so that we put out these one-word prompts each day. And, you know, I'd do a week and somebody else would do a week. And then 2 years ago, Sarah joined us. And so we've been writing ever since in this way. And there's just four of us. And we haven't even met the other two women who are in the group. One lives in Toronto and one lives in New Mexico. But they're really closer to us than most of the people I know, because when you write together, you have to be honest or you might as well just forget it. So there's a reference in here to the word that I was supposed to be using that day. So, Conspiracy of Ravens. A conspiracy of ravens waddled about on sharp rocks beside the rippling waters, muttering, "It's not just ducks who waddle, you know." Arbutus was listening to their chortling and squabbling, swaying to ocean breezes, fancying herself Karen Kane, prima ballerina. Two eagles, newly in love, nestling side by side, think about some shiny, gray, fast-moving dinner, flashing sparkles below, daring them to dive as they survey the scene from Grandmother Cedar's top branch. One saying to the other, "She's supposed to use the word imaginative today." In a sentence, you know. And she's prevaricating. Coyote strolls by, hears them, and says, "Doesn't she think this scene is imaginative enough?" Sniffs the pungent breeze and pads off. Tail fur feathering down the wet sand in search of dinner called cat. Thank you. are going to sing a hymn now that really is part of I want to do an introduction, though, of the poet first. It's number 3 in your hymnal if you want to look at it, but I was going to read it to you, just the words. It's just easier to see first. It's a poem. It's from a poem by Edna St. Vincent Millay, and I have to say I did not know her poetry. I had heard her name, but that was all. I never studied her in school. She was American, and she was born in 1882 and died in 1950. And she was a very, very well-known and famous American woman poet. She was the third woman, actually, to win a Pulitzer Prize for poetry, which is really something, in 1923. And what I discovered about her was that she was a feminist activist, hooray, and her second name, well, St. Vincent was her second name, and she always, right from elementary school days, wanted to be called Vincent. So she was way ahead of her time, and if she'd lived now, she would have had a little bit more freedom with that. And so the school wouldn't allow it, the school she went to, but her family and friends always called her Vincent, which I find quite fascinating and terrific. So she married, and she was married for a long time, but she said of her husband and her relationship, "We lived like two bachelors. He does all the household work, and I do my work writing poetry." And I thought that was terrific. So one kind of poignant side note to that is I had to find all of this on Google because unfortunately, my partner, Helga, had told me that she really liked Edna St. Vincent Millay's poetry. But do you know, like, life takes over with us so many times. We are tired, we're busy, we're preoccupied, whatever. And I never asked her what she loved about Edna St. Vincent Millay's poetry, or was there a particular poem that she really loved that we could read together? I never did that. And it sort of is a lesson, I think, in, you know, now she's gone. She's on the other side. So that's not possible anymore. So let me just read it. "The world stands out on either side, no wider than the heart is wide. Above the world is stretched the sky, no higher than the soul is high. The heart can push the sea and land so far away on either hand. The soul can split the sky in two and let the face of God shine through." So, will you rise now, as you're willing and able, and sing hymn number 3.
Thank you. Testing. Testing. Good. This is a poem from my first book of poetry called Markings in the Mail by a Sydney Boy. And it's basically a travelogue, so I won't introduce it. It's about a sailing trip between Sydney and Bute Inlet, up and back, solo sailing. And so here we go. The land was a loom, and history was a tapestry, when wistfully I sailed northward beyond the Salish Sea, and thought of the first peoples of the coast, imagined the sacred balance they valued most. From old-growth forests, the howl of wolf, rippling rivers, salmon spawning and bears marking tree bark to slivers, masked elders dancing as spirits of all their relations, as whales, seals, and otters coexisting under constellations. In the great bear rainforest, black ravens use tools, reveal medleys of colorful anemones that brighten the pools. The land itself beyond the town speak from mountains high, where eagles spiral from misty blues in spiritual cry. From birdsong and the bear's splashing paws, from rutting moose and cougar's clinging claws, the land as a whole has an immense bioacoustic scale, where hunters thanked the giving of flesh by tail, and felt in their bodies and sensed by their affinities. The Chinese spoke of sensing place by the four dignities of standing, of reposing, of sitting, and of walking. Indigenous peoples of the passage added of paddling, for the Haida and Salish sang their paddles to taboos, to the rhythm of their drums in their clan-crested canoes. Storied people transformed by hands the mighty trees. Clothed in bark, they marked this land above the screes. In fact, history was a tapestry, and the land was their loom, where kelps rippled in water worlds to the otter's tune. Whispering air has a silence that speaks when I hear it, as a roar of death from peaking storms when I see it. Beings and things can be heard and seen as the lichen spread filaments across bark in mist as they tighten to seven shades of green that drape, droop, and trap carbon for their foliage filled with sap, making the air for life, lifting up the waters for the matrilineal mothers and their daughters. Inside the veins of Mother Earth, the magmas flow beneath fjords where crystallized glaciers glow, where above the fires of longhouse ceremonies glowed, where stories of animal connections were totem-poled. That's where the people shared and needed neither dollars, estates, nor Scottish laird. The land was a loom, and history was a tapestry, when wistfully I sailed southward toward the Salish Sea, and thought of European loggers along the coast, imagined the measured volumes they valued most. Modern hieroglyphics spoke from the clear cuts, convex and concaved, slopes of burgundy and orange bark from trees felled and shaved. Atop the beige hills and in the gullies, the silver drying snags and the brilliant pink of fire weed tags. A tapestry of times and work, a museum of lives that lurk. Once logging camps at the head of the inlets floated, where booms were walked, tagged, tied, and sorted. Now rusting red donkeys and cables no longer creak, Neither do men bag booms, nor grappler yarders shriek. Nor do the standing spar trees sway near feller-notched trunks, beyond the floating sleeper cabins and their bunks. The names, they speak the work of exploitations, the men camps of the coast that brought temptations. Bull buckers, ringing slingers, cat skinners, boom men, and whistle punks. Old bunk houses have tumbled from fish canneries, no reeking chunks. The Vietnam draft dodgers and Canucks that follow the loggers forever borrowed hoisting winches, engines, cutlery, fuel, grease, and generators, where white shells rattle down the ebbing sea like shard. Listing homes, float homes, still grumble when hauled on hard. The land was a loom, and history was a tapestry. When I sailed south to Desolation Sound in the Salish Sea, and thought of the few old growth forests that still remain, and of our need to preserve them, or forever shame. Just to finish that, as I finished writing this poem, I was in Grace Harbor in Desolation Sound, and suddenly the desolation arrived. Five or six huge power boats that were like 40 feet long, with dogs on them all barking and shrieking to go ashore to have a pee. And then the competition between boats launching to take their dogs ashore, and all the outboard motors starting. And I had been silently anchored there for about 4 hours before they all arrived. And so that was the end of my story. And poets sometimes, you look at a poem and you think, oh, there's one part left to write. And so sometime I'll probably talk about the arrival of those power boats as the finish of the poem.
Thank you. Thank you, Wally. Okay. Can you hear me now? Yeah, okay. So Shelley's homily, as it appears in the order of service, is titled, "There Is Some Awe, the Joys of Reading and Writing Poetry." Well, I would feel a bit of a fraud standing here to talk about the awe of writing and reading poetry, considering I do very little of either. So I will call my brief reflection, "There Is Some Awe, Even for Those Who Don't Always Read and Write Poetry." Recently, I came across a poem that engaged and delighted me. It was a fusion of beautifully crafted words with the stunning visual art of an impressionist painter. That's what appealed to me and shifted my perspective of both. I'd like to share the poem with you, a little background. It was written by Liesl Mühl, who was born in Hamburg, Germany in 1924. Her poem takes on the persona of French impressionist painter Claude Monet. You may be familiar with Monet's iconic paintings of water lilies, and he painted many scenes of his garden at his home in northern France. He also painted grand architecture, such as the cathedral at Rouen and the House of Parliament in London. He was a master of light and color. But in his later years, Monet suffered from cataracts, and this probably affected his art in the way that he saw and painted light and structure. A doctor told him that he should have surgery to remove the cataracts and improve his vision. He refused the surgery. And poet Liesl Mühl channels the artist Monet's reasoning in this poem entitled, "Monet Refuses the Operation." Doctor, you say there are no halos around the streetlights in Paris, and what I see is an aberration caused by old age, an affliction. I tell you, it has taken me all my life to arrive at the vision of gas lamps as angels, to soften and blur and finally banish the edges you regret I don't see, to learn that the line I call the horizon does not exist, and sky and water, so long apart, are the same state of being. 54 years before I could see Rouen Cathedral, it is built of parallel shafts of sun, and now you want to restore my youthful errors, fixed notions of top and bottom, the illusion of three-dimensional space, wisteria separate from the bridge it covers. What can I say to convince you the Houses of Parliament dissolves night after night to become the fluid dream of the Thames? I will not return to a universe of objects that don't know each other, as if islands were not the lost children of one great continent. The world is flux, and light becomes what it touches, becomes water, lilies on water, above and below water, becomes lilac and mauve and yellow and white and cerulean lamps, small fists passing sunlight so quickly to one another that it would take long streaming hair inside my brush to catch it, to paint the speed of light. Our weighted shapes, these verticals, burn to mix with air and change our bones, skin, clothes to gases. Doctor, if only you could see how heaven pulls earth into its arms and how infinitely the heart expands to claim this world, blue vapor without end. So we now get to sing another poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson. It's called Ring Out Wild Bells, and it is number 58 in the Gray Songbook. So please rise in body or spirit to sing this beautiful poem.
Whew. I didn't know I was going to have to follow Alfred Lord Tennyson. One of my favorite poets is somebody who writes in English, but English is his third language, and it's the only one he knows. He was born in Yugoslavia, and when he was 5 or 6, his family moved to France and said, "We're not from there anymore, we're French now. Now we only speak French in this house." And in his early teens, they moved to the U.S., and the father said, "We're not French anymore, we're Americans. From now on, only English." So he's the only poet I know the only language he knows is his third language. I don't know if you can call him trilingual or monolingual or non-monolingual. Anyway, his name is Charles Simic. He's a wonderful writer. And he said this about poetry. Poetry is a piece of meat carried by a burglar to distract a watchdog. In other words, poetry is often telling us something that we're trying not to hear. We have an old saying now, South, "I ain't trying to hear that." So how do you get people to hear what they're not listening for and what they don't want to hear and what they're already sure they can't understand? And it's either going too fast or too slow, or it's in the wrong language, or it's at the wrong rhythm. Poets use all these tricks like meter and rhyme and imagery and biographical connection to the work, anything to get us thinking that we're listening so that the burglar can get in past the watchdog. I hope we all brought our watchdog to church this morning. Here's one that I sometimes use to get past the watchdog. This is called "A Letter to Henry Taylor." "Let's get this over with. My theme is brevity, the soul of wit. So in conclusion, since I seem to be digressing, this is it." Henry Taylor is a poet, a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, who happens to be a friend of mine. And he often began his poetry readings with a poem that was almost like a dirty joke, something borderline obscene. People were so shocked they couldn't believe they're hearing this. And that got them in the state of mind to quit listening for poetry and just listen. I was vacationing one year in North Carolina, on the Outer Banks. And when I wasn't at the beach getting sunburned, I would go into all the tourist shops and little places where they sell seashells and art and crystals and jewelry and stuff. And every store I went into seemed to have 6 paintings of a lighthouse. You know, I mean, you go to the beach to paint, what are you going to paint, right? The seagulls, the horizon, the sand, the lighthouse. And lighthouses are pretty important if you live near the water, I guess. But I'm kind of contrary. So I thought, well, you know, all those people that are lost out there in the dark, this beam of light, that'll help them. But what about the ones that are lost in the light? So this is called the dark house. I get tired of it. I decide to do something. I move to Brittany. On the cliffs of Quiberon, I build a dark house. I fit it with a lamp so powerful, the black sweep of its beam is visible morning and afternoon, all up and down the coast, far out beyond Belle Isle. Every day, all day, I man the tower, just in case. If only one is saved, it will be worth it. I often think of my poems as being like a detective novel. I think the poet is like a detective sometime. He's trying to solve a mystery. He's not sure what he's looking for or who he should talk to or what's a clue and what's not. And I found some support for this in the poetry of Thomas Hardy. He wrote a poem called Wessex Heights. And in that poem he says he'd rather be out in the country because in the towns I'm tracked by phantoms having weird detective ways. Well, I think we're all tracked by phantoms with weird detective ways. So this is called Someone with a Sense of Direction. And I don't know if the detective's the one talking or the one being talked about. On an evening of the long, light rain, as you sit upstairs with the windows open, let someone with a sense of direction come along the sidewalk underneath. Let the stranger pass beside the nameless trees, then cut across the street, and let it take all night.
Thinking a little bit deeper. This last poem did all that for me and a little bit more. It helped me find my voice and speak my truth, even when it wasn't very easy. So the poem I'm about to read is by Araya Mountain Dreamer. She's a spiritual teacher out in Ontario, and I was very fortunate to do a week-long retreat with her called Writing Close to the Bone. And she had just written this poem. The invitation. It doesn't interest me what you do for a living. I want to know what you ache for, and if you dare to dream of meeting your heart's longing. It doesn't interest me what planets are squaring your moon. I want to know if you've touched the center of your own sorrow, if you have been opened by life's betrayals, or have become shriveled and closed from fear of further pain. I want to know if you can sit with pain, mine or your own, without moving to hide it, fade it, or fix it. I want to know if you can be with joy, mine or your own, if you can dance with the wildness and let the ecstasy fill you to the tips of your fingers and toes, without cautioning us to be careful, be realistic, or to remember the limitations of being human. Doesn't interest me if the story you're telling me is true. I want to know if you can disappoint another to be true to yourself. If you can bear the accusation of betrayal and not betray your own self. I want to know if you can live with failure, yours and mine, and still stand at the edge of the lake and shout to the silver of the moon, yes! It doesn't interest me who you are or how you came to be here. I want to know if you can stand in the center of the fire with me and not shrink back. Doesn't interest me where or what or with whom you studied. I want to know what sustains you from the inside when all else falls away. I want to know if you can be alone with yourself and if you truly like the company you keep in the empty moments.